Hello there, and welcome to the Three Drinks In podcast, episode number 130. In this episode, we are waiting for Mr. Clint Eastwood to show up and talk about his new film, The Mule. Before we do that, though, I want to remind you that Three Drinks In is available on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, and now Overcast and Radio Public. Just search for Three Drinks In podcast. You'll easily find us. Click subscribe, tell your friends, and leave a review. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Three Drinks In Pod. Excuse me. Like us on Facebook and email us at threedrinksinpodcast@gmail.com. That's it.
That's it.
Okay. Episode number 130 with Clint Eastwood. That was his daughter, who played his daughter in the movie?
No.
Yeah. Apparently, because like, I was just looking at the IMDb, and I see she has the same name. I'm like, oh, okay. It's interesting. Is it a coincidence, or is it actually his kid? It is one of his 8 children that we know about. Mm-hmm. Apparently, Mr. Eastwood has lived a very non-traditional lifestyle when it comes to his female companions. So it's like his personal life has its own page on Wikipedia.
Yeah, I think I remember that. Like, didn't he leave his wife and throw everything out into the street and disown her or something?
Maybe. I mean, the little bit that I read said that he began a relationship with his first wife when they were very young and continued to have affairs and then had an open relationship. And then he would divorce her and marry other people and continue to have other relationships. And some people were cool then, and some were not. And it's weird. And I don't know. Something about that just rubs me the wrong way.
Mm-hmm.
So, especially because, like, he's, I guess he was a libertarian initially, but he's been a Republican. I don't know. He's been involved with that party for years, doing that really weird thing at the convention a few years ago with the empty chair, and you know. So,
well, I think nowadays we've seen that you don't have to be Republican to have, you know, high moral standards for yourself.
Yeah, I just kind of thought that since he was sort of an older one, that maybe he was cut from something a little bit more traditional, but apparently not.
No, I don't think so.
No Ronald Reagan, that's for damn sure. So, but he's a pretty good actor.
He's a good actor.
Good
director. And a good director too.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of the last. Because, like, this is just what Clint Eastwood does now, is he makes Clint Eastwood movies. And I'm trying to figure out.
I think American Sniper was his last big one, wasn't it?
Yes, okay. So I guess there's two categories of Clint Eastwood movies. There's movies that he's in and movies that he's not in.
Yeah.
And, Sniper was that one. And I'm trying to get the pull up the damn Wikipedia page. And I'm trying, you know, before that, you know, Gran Torino and Trouble with the Curve and Million Dollar Baby, Space Cowboys. These are all kind of things that, you know, he's just kind of putting himself in the foreground for doing. But because he's made some legitimately amazing films. I mean, We rented The Bridges of Madison County years ago, like a year or two ago, and like we bought like a copy from then like the download from Amazon didn't work, and so we didn't finish it. But he was really good in that.
Physical media.
Well, we were just renting it. I didn't want to buy it. Yeah. But
oh yeah.
Anyway, but like that's, you know, that and Unforgiven kind of stand out. I've never actually seen Unforgiven, just like clips of it, but Jesus,
you know. Yeah, I don't know if I should see that again. I saw that in high school, and I remember being bored, and it was very long, and you know, you get the point of the whole thing in the first 20 minutes, and then it goes on for another 2 hours.
Yeah.
But I think it's interesting that he makes all these movies for older people, because he's an older person. I went on a Tuesday to see this movie, and it was me and 99 geriatrics.
Yeah, I actually, it was funny. I went on Tuesday as well, and Tuesday is the $5 night at my local theater. And so I've been lucky the past few times that I've gone to the movies near me that the movie hasn't been well attended. And so I'll walk in, you know, right as the whole thing's getting going, because we do very few trailers at this theater. And, you know, there's nobody in there. I can sit wherever I want. Not true this time. A bunch of senior citizens who were itching for a bargain were there, and I had to sit like the second row. And it's a very small theater, so it didn't bother me that much. But yeah, I was surprised. Like, oh, you're all here. Okay.
Yeah.
You know.
But they're there to see him in an older type of movie. Like, they showed previews for this for things before the movie started. And you could just hear the befuddlement at the Captain Marvel trailer. They were just sitting there like, what the hell is this? And I was like, why are they showing this trailer for these people? You know, there's a couple others like that where they were just like, well, I wouldn't see something that stupid. You know?
Yeah.
Just, you could just hear them saying it.
It's the wrong crowd, guys. Yeah, I'm trying to think of the trailers I saw. I think the one I saw was for the ugly Nicole Kidman movie. She's making a movie. I can't think of what it's called. Defiant or Defender or I don't know, something with a D. And she's doing what Charlize Theron did with Monster back in the day. And she's just they take an attractive actress and they make them look unattractive, and then they win an Oscar. It's really, really funny. Like, you know, like the bravest thing you can do in Hollywood as far as acting roles is concerned is making yourself look unattractive. Which is not entirely wrong. I remember when, what's it called? I was reading that book by William Goldman. He was saying, like, most, you know, most movie stars don't want to look like the bad guy in whatever they do. Except for a few great actors like Robert Duvall and a few others who are real character actors. And this is as close to character acting as people get, is like when Brad Pitt or Charlize Theron or now Nicole Kidman make themselves physically hideous and overact their way to an Oscar.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just kind of like, oh, all right, interesting.
I think that was different then too, that, you know, I mean, that's a good book about Hollywood, William Goldman, but that's dated now. And like, he used to talk a lot about, you know, movie star power and what makes this person a star. We don't know, but people come in and to see them specifically. And that's not really true anymore.
Well,
you slap Tom Cruise in a movie and people won't go to see it because it's Tom Cruise. They'll go to see it because it's Mission Impossible.
You know, I actually, so yeah, that's truer now than it was when Goldman wrote that book in the early 80s. So, yeah. But I actually think that there is something to movie stars. It's just, it's a different kind of marketing. So Clint Eastwood makes these movies and people go see them because he's in them. You know, people went to see American Sniper because it was a true story about a, you know, an American hero, and it was supposed to be a good movie, and it was kind of a unique thing, and that's why that was. Oh, and it's also directed by Clint Eastwood. So great. So, but when he's in the movie, he is actually drawing older people who are not interested in you know, superhero movies to the theater. And I think people would go see a Mission Impossible movie without Tom Cruise, but that it's Tom Cruise who's like in charge of it and sort of shepherding the project along and doing all of his own stunts. Like, That's the draw. It's not just come see Tom Cruise because he's a good actor, but come see Tom Cruise do this thing that the underwriters really didn't want him to do because the insurance went through the roof on the picture. You know, all these different, you know, aspects of his stardom. You put him in The Mummy, and you don't really advertise it as a Tom Cruise movie because it really wasn't. Then that movie bombs. I mean, that was a bad movie, I'm told. I didn't actually see it. But I'm willing to bet that a large portion of the blame goes to the fact that it was marketed terribly. You know, they wasted time and money putting big-name people in these roles, and then they didn't bother to really tell you that, hey, we got Tom Cruise to be in a Mummy movie. That's your angle on selling the star. It isn't just slapping, you know, Redford's name on the poster and saying, oh, well, I'll go see it because I like him. You know, it's different than that. It's more complicated to kind of make use of the star as opposed to just saying we got this guy in this picture. And so it's you know, you're going to draw your biggest crowds to a Marvel movie or a DC movie because it's the character that you're going to see. But there is still something to be said for stars depending on how you market it, I think. And also depending on the audience. Like these folks that we sat through this with are not going to see Captain Marvel, but they'll go see the latest Clint Eastwood picture because it's him.
Mm-hmm. So what did you think of The Mule?
The Mule. I was thinking we should do a quick recap of the plot before we start on some of these things. So The Mule is the story of, what's his name? Earl Stone. A retired or forced into retirement horticulturalist? Do they quite say what it is exactly he does?
He crossbreeds flowers.
Right, orchids, I think, primarily.
Mm-hmm.
Earl's about 102 years old and not what you would call your model family man, as it turns out. Art imitating life. Falls on hard times, loses his farm, and goes to work as a drug mule for the cartel. And runs up and down between, I guess it's, where did he go, Mexico? Or I'm not quite sure what his route is, but he's based out of Chicago, right?
He goes to Texas, I think, usually.
Okay. So, yeah, drives from Texas to Chicago, shuffling up and down about, I don't know, a few $100 million worth of cocaine over the course of his 12 or so trips. And we watch Earl sort of struggle with the end of his life in terms of choices he's made and choices he's continuing to make and how they're impacting and shaping the people in his life.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not bad. Not a bad movie. But I always kind of, I don't know. He's a hard character to read. You know, and I was never quite sure exactly whether to feel tense about certain things or whether to find things funny. But you know, the thing that you take a character, you put him in an atypical situation and you wait for something to happen, and nothing ever really happens to him. You know, he gets hooked up with the drug dealers. He is not scared of pretty much anything the entire time, even though stuff that's really scary. You know, at the end, you know, when the stakes kind of get raised a bit, he definitely takes notice, but he just kind of hard-asses his way through the script, and the tension builds here and there, and the movie just kind of proceeds apace. Like they do their best to add twists and turns to raise tension in certain places, but I don't know. It was kind of a deflated balloon by the end of it, I felt. So like he learns a lesson, but it doesn't seem like it was something that he didn't really know all along. Like, he knew he was a bad father. He knew he was a bad husband and grandfather, and it, that it essentially cost him all the relationships with his family, except for his granddaughter. And he cared so little about it that he almost appeared kind of sociopathic in a way. And, you know, he makes the right decision at the end of the movie, you know, when his wife is dying. But he kind of just always knew this was the right thing to do, and he just kind of falls into it naturally, and he surprises his family. But it doesn't seem like he realized anything. He just kind of did the thing he always knew he was supposed to do, which makes you wonder, well, if you always knew this is what you were supposed to do, why did it take you 70 years to do it? And it doesn't make him any more likable, which they want you to, I think they wanted you to like him more by the end because he was finally doing the right thing. But you're kind of like, well, what took you so long at the same time? I mean, I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, he doesn't have a moral compass about anything, including all the drug smuggling. Like, that's really kind of what got me, was that, like, when he gets invited to the party at the drug cartel boss's house, like, that was weird to me. Because the whole time you think, okay, well, he's hard up for cash. They foreclosed on his house and his farm, so he had to sell that or lose that. And then he takes this job out of desperation, or so we think. But he's not desperate, it seems. He's just kind of living life and going out and meeting hookers and doing the whole thing. And then then you figure he's going to do this for a while and say, okay, that's it. Now I'm done. I did three routes and now I'm finished. But no, it's like he keeps going, making all this money, and the money is the motivation. But when he actually goes to the guy's house and goes to the party and he's having a great time, I'm like, this is weird. Shouldn't you kind of have some sense of, like, you know, like, you should feel bad about what you're doing, right? But he never really does. And the final thing at the end, when he accepts responsibility, he's kind of over-rewarded for that by his family. Like, oh, we're going to come talk to you now. We're going to come see you whenever. Like, he's still a jerk. Just because he sat by, you know, his wife's bedside for 5 days watching her die doesn't, you know, he did so many bad things.
Yeah, the problem with the movie is it's not well written.
That's also true.
And I spent a lot of time trying to, like, rack my brain to figure out why so much of the movie didn't work. Because he's fine, and the scenes with him are fine. You know, he's a good actor, and he plays old white man really well. You know, like, he's casually racist, but it's not overwhelming. And he distrusts how to use phones and the internet. I'm like, yeah, okay. I've met this person 1,000 times. That's fine. So it's not his acting or anything, but it's just not written well. And so I dare anyone to defy or to tell me, what's the point of him running drugs? To save his house? When does he ever say, I need to save my house? And then it's like, okay, now what? He's going to go on another run to pay for his granddaughter's wedding? That's nice, but when did he say that was a necessity? And then the third time, he just happens to do it because he's like, oh, the VA burned down, even though, is he part of the VA? Because every time he's in the VA hall, he's like, gee, it'll be hard for everyone here to have a party. I don't know what you guys are going to do. Shouldn't he have been saying what we're going to do? Is he part of this?
That's true. Yeah, he uses the you instead of the we.
And then after that, there is no reason. He just keeps going. And at first I'm thinking, like, well, maybe now he's in too deep. Like, they won't let him quit. No. In fact, they show, you know, several times that him and, you know, all the Mexican guys in the garage that keep giving him the drugs, they're quite friendly. They like him. He seems to, like, win over everybody, you know, because he's just an affable kind of guy.
And he's affable and he's fearless too. Like, one of the things that they sort of respect is that he's not afraid of them, it seems. the one guy pulls a gun on him when he's put, you know, the I guess the second in command of the whole thing, where what's his name, Anthony Garcia sends this guy to go kind of watch him, and you're not quite sure why either. I don't recall, like, why he's it's like sent a handler. Do you remember what that reason was?
They give him the handler because they didn't understand what he was doing. Like, they don't understand why he's so good at it. And it turns out it's because he doesn't follow any pattern and he doesn't follow any timetable. Like, when he wants to stop to help people on the side of the road, he does it. Or when he wants to stop and get food at a restaurant, he just does it.
Right.
And since he's white and old and he drives at the speed limit, he never gets stopped. He's not suspicious. And it's not until after they kill the first drug lord and they put the second, more hard-ass drug lord in there, there's like, he has to go by the timetable we set, and that's what gets him caught. You know?
Right. Yeah. Which
and that has no bearing whatsoever on whether or not he wants to. Like, I thought, like, oh no, how's he going to do that? They're just like, they threaten him in the woods, you know, you better start following the timetable. And he goes, okay. And the only thing that stops him is his wife dying.
Yeah.
But other than that, he would have been perfectly fine to follow the timetable. So, like, for an hour and a half of the film, I'm like, why is this happening?
Yeah. Also, who was the guy in the trunk?
I think that was one of the guys in the garage, right?
Right. Like, I think, but I don't know.
Yeah,
he definitely recognized him, and he said his name, but I didn't catch the guy's name in the beginning. And another thing about it that bugged me is that, so he kind of forms a relationship with the handler, you know, to the point where, you know, it was almost like that Charles Grodin and Robert De Niro movie. I can't think of the name of it, where, like, De Niro's a bounty hunter and he goes to get Charles Grodin, who's, I think it's like a white collar crime he's wanted for, and the guy just drives him insane the entire time he's being, you know, driven back to whatever jurisdiction that they want him in. And it's kind of like that, like, just unlikely friendship develops between two characters, which gets dropped right away. He kind of says to him, as they're showing you the dead body in the trunk, hey, buddy, and he's like, don't you buddy me, and then that character doesn't appear again in the movie.
Yeah, I wonder, like, I can see what they were going for. So in a normal movie that we're used to, that has a payoff at the end where, like, there's a shootout and the guy turns and saves the old man at the end. Like, he realizes.
Right.
That doesn't happen. There is no shootout. So my guess is that the guy, like, that's the scene where he was supposed to sort of say one or the other, like, hey, I'm with the cartel or I'm not. And he chooses the cartel. So you're right. That was annoying. The guy doesn't come back. And then when the movie ended, I'm like, oh, there was no shootout. So, all right, that's fine. But also, there was never a moment where he makes up with his daughter. And so, like, you have this one moment where he's like, you shouldn't be part of the cartel, my friend. You're a good guy. You're better than this, even though he's not. He's a murderous, psychopath cartel member. But you would think that, like, he learned that lesson and now he's going to apply it to the good side of his life, or with his actual real family. But there isn't a scene like that. They just forgive him. Like, this is the woman who not only wouldn't speak to him, but would get up in a church and move out of the way to avoid him. And the next 20 minutes, she's like, we still love you, Pop, no matter what. I'm like, who ripped the page out of the script that had them reconciling?
I think you were supposed to take the fact that he was sitting by the ex-wife's bedside for that week, and they're standing there watching him from the doorway as, like, you know, that's the moment that they all kind of come, oh, we want you to come to Thanksgiving dinner. You know,
yeah.
Like, oh, all right, all's forgiven then, I guess. NBD.
Yeah, so it was missing all those things, and a lot of it was strained, and I didn't understand why any of it was happening. Like, even the beginning, when he gets into the drug business, He crashes his granddaughter's engagement party or something.
No, he's invited. He shows up.
But he just shows up, and they're all like stunned. And then her bridesmaid's friend approaches him, and is like, "Hey, if you're looking for work, call these guys." And I'm like, "What would possibly make you want to ask Clint Eastwood, who's 90, he's got everything he owns in his truck, to start running drugs? Like, where do you get that idea? Right outside on the street, outside the house."
Is there anything that they say in the very public argument that they have about, because he approaches the car and he notices all the stickers, and that, you know, and you know, they have a conversation about that he used to drive a lot for whatever he did. And I'm trying to think if there was anything that was said that the guy was like kind of picked up on, like, I should listen to this.
No, because you would expect, you know, I had that expectation from other Clint Eastwood movies that the old man and the young Hispanic guy were going to have some sort of, miscommunication, sort of like, I'm going to offer you this job in selling drugs and you're going to be offended at that. Like, I don't need a job. Well, I don't need you punk kids and this and that. But he just sort of shrugs like, yep. Yep, I'll call him. And then he just does it. And then when he finds out it's drugs, he's like, okay, I won't even look. Whatever, it's fine.
I mean, what does he think it is? Because there was a moment when, like, I guess it was the scene where he gets caught by the cop in the beginning. And that's like the third run he was on. Second or third run. Wasn't the first one. But the first one, he drives up. There's this guy with a giant machine gun. You know, they're talking to him in Spanish. They're covered in tattoos. You have to be a moron not to know what you're doing. They put the thing in his bag. They say, don't look at it. Just drive it here. Get out of the car in the hotel and somebody will take it. And then that's it. Okay. But the third run, he opens it up and it's full of cocaine. And he's like, like, he's shocked. Shocked, well, I say.
Like, you get the impression that he doesn't understand what's going on when he's in that garage with those guys. But you're sitting here like, no one's that stupid. Unless they're actually senile, and he's not.
He's not.
Yeah. And then you also get the impression that, like, they're not quite sure what to make of this guy, but they're going to trust all their drugs with him.
Well,
which I thought was kind of odd, too.
Yes and no. I mean, it is a risk for them to give it to this guy to move, but the worst thing that happens is that he gets arrested and he tells them where he picked up the drugs. Like, he still goes to jail, so he takes the fall. And he says, I got it from, you know, a tire shop in El Paso, and this is the address. And they get to the tire shop in El Paso, and, you know, they find three low-level guys there with automatic weapons, and they go to jail for life. And, like, so, like, maybe they all flip? I don't know. But, like, having this guy do it sort of insulates them from being arrested. Like, I'm not quite, it's, the whole thing is risky, but that's the drug business, everybody.
Yeah.
If you can't take the heat, don't sell cocaine.
Yeah. So what did you think of Bradley Cooper?
That could have been literally anybody. Like, I could have played that part, and it didn't really matter. Like, you know, he kind of had superpowers in that he knew, like, a few things about people. You know, I guess you're supposed to take it that he's experienced and he's made a lot of busts. And
yeah, well, like, they give him a setup in the beginning.
Yeah, you want to get out of here.
Yeah, like, you don't want to be here, but you're good at what you do, and as soon as you're really good at what you do here, you can move on again. And I was like, okay. So he has some sort of motivation to catch the drug mule. And you kind of get the impression that he doesn't see his family very much. But I thought it was oddly structured in that all of these different things. So there's Clint Eastwood being a mule. There's Clint Eastwood's family. And then there's Bradley Cooper and Michael Pena, who for once is not a motor mouth.
Actually, and he's been in a lot of movies where he's not doing that shtick.
Yeah, but not recently.
No, but he's really good in all of them. Have you noticed how good an actor this guy is?
Oh, yeah. No, I like him a lot. I'm just saying, like, I was expecting him to be, like, the wisecracking partner or something, like the comic relief maybe, but he wasn't. There was no comic relief.
Yeah. And the one thing that bugged me about his character was that, I guess this was done for a different reason, but he mentioned that he has 5 kids.
Yeah. And so I thought maybe he gets shot or something.
Right? That's kind of where I thought they were going with it. But I guess what he's the other reason they did that is which is less interesting, is that Bradley Cooper's character asks him, "How do you make that work?" He's like, "I don't know, you just do." Which is not a very helpful answer. But that was
it's the point.
It's like, the point. Yeah, it's to say, like, I have 5 kids and I make it work. You have less than 5 kids, and you can't seem to hold it together.
And Clint Eastwood too, like, he can't keep it together, even though he only has 1 daughter.
Which it's funny because, like, in the case of Clint Eastwood's character, he's in the wrong. He's the one. You see him, like, when he's 90 years old, going around to these trade shows, and hanging out at the bar when he knows he's missing his daughter's wedding, which is freaking terrible. But Bradley Cooper's character is just a workaholic at an honest job. It isn't like he's out at the bar hanging out with his flower buddies. He's working, and it's a demanding job, and maybe his wife's a pain in the ass. Maybe Michael Pena's wife is really understanding, like it's sort of a more complicated thing and not entirely analogous.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, I guess that, they're sort of a foil to each other, but not really.
I mean, what bothered me was that all those 3 sections weren't interwoven in any way. They were all very separate. So there were huge chunks where I forgot about Bradley Cooper because I was watching Clint Eastwood at that party in Mexico, and then he was back on the road again, and then it would be like his wife. And then all of a sudden, boom, Bradley Cooper and that snitch. And I'm like, oh, yeah, how's that going? Oh, apparently it's going well. Okay, then. So the problem with the writing was that they didn't have much of effect on one another until the end, when they just sort of merge. And they don't merge, streamlined. So, like, all of a sudden, just bam, I'm going to go see my wife. And bam, the deathbed repentance. And then boom, we would love to have you. And then the next scene, he gets pulled over by the cops, and it's over.
Yeah. I mean, you know where it's going, so nothing really ends up as, like, a surprise. Like, why did that happen? Like, there are certain character motivations that you question, like why he's doing all of this and why he has no compunction, really, about doing any of it, even though it's all pretty terrible. But how the movie proceeds sort of, just makes sense. At some point, the leisurely way and sort of humorous and jovial way he goes about running cocaine for Mexican drug cartels, something has to happen. Okay, so the kind of, the very happy-go-lucky drug lord gets killed by a not-so-happy-go-lucky guy in a cowboy hat. By the way, the guy that shot Andy Garcia, I think I said Anthony Garcia before, but Andy Garcia, is that one of the 2 brothers from Breaking Bad?
No.
Oh, look just like him with a beard.
Well, that's fucking racist of you.
Okay.
Well, I just thought it was hilarious.
I'm sure that's true, but
I just thought it was hilarious how, like, obviously stereotypical all of those guys were. It was a bit much.
Yeah. And they never spoke, they just stood there and, like,
they could just wear regular clothing. Like, they don't have to be dressed like cowboys.
Or like the leather vest with nothing underneath it.
Yeah. I was like, oh my God, what is this?
It's hot in the sun. Why would you wear a black leather?
I know.
I don't understand. Although,
Jeans are chafing,
I I work in an area with a very heavily Hispanic population, and there is at least one store I know of in the city that has they sell just cowboy wear, you know, Stetsons and all these boots, and like it is a style of dress that people from Mexico, you know, utilize. So it's not.
I'm not saying none of them. They didn't have to be dressed like they work at Hollister. I'm just saying they don't all have to dress like that.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's not. It's a stretch, but not a huge one.
Yeah.
But anyway, I forget where I was going with that. I did find that line really funny when he shows up at the house and he's impressed by it and he goes, "Oh, who do you have to kill to live here?" And he goes, "Many, many people."
Yeah, many, many people.
Which is both funny and kind of awkward. Like, gosh, like, you know, he's killed people. Like, he comes across as so dumb at some of these moments. And like, I don't know.
That's the problem of motivation.
Yeah.
Is he in it because he wants to be? Is he like a Walter White? Like, I'm good at this, so I'm going to keep doing it. Is it, I just need the money? Am I trying to prove something?
Yeah, you never really know why anyone does anything, or why he does anything. You know why people have reactions to what he's doing, but they have them very much to the very immediate thing he's doing.
And I disagree with most people who say that it has to be more. So, like, in Breaking Bad, it's more than money. It's because it's the one thing in his life where he feels he has some sort of control, as bad as it is.
And also that, like, he was an underemployed chemist. He was a brilliant chemist, and he didn't get a chance to do any chemistry. He was just teaching it to kids.
Right. Like, this is what I'm good at this, and I'm using my full talents, and I'm appreciated. Sure, I'm appreciated by psychopaths and meth addicts, but people want me. They want me for this. Like, when I'm sitting and teaching in school, I'm not appreciated. And that's fine. But you can also just be a greedy asshole. Like, that's fine as motivation. I remember I was sitting in class once with the professor, and we were talking about The Princess and the Frog, that Disney movie. And he was extremely disappointed that Disney didn't take the opportunity to explore race relations or whatever it was. And that the villain turned out to be one black, but also his greed was his only motivation. And he had voodoo powers or whatever. It was a cartoon. But he said, like, is he really the villain? I mean, not really. He only wants money and blah, blah, blah. And I'm sitting here going, yeah, that's everyone on the fucking planet. Most people want money. 95% of us won't do anything immoral or illegal to get it. However, that does not stop people, the other 5%, from doing ridiculously illegal things. And being greedy is fine. Especially in the beginning where he's like, I need my house. And if it had snowballed into, you know, he got the new car, you know, he had the big black Jeep. I replaced my old Jeep. And then show us what he's doing with that money, you know, besides being a good guy. Like, what else is he doing? Is he fixing up the house? Is he getting another car? Is he going on vacations? You know, like, I think of Catch Me If You Can. Some of that is money, and some of that is I want to impress my father and get my mother and father back together.
Yeah.
You can have both motivations. Having none is the problem.
Yeah, you know, it can be as simple as that, and you know, usually the simple thing will snowball. Like, if they had a setup, if it had been written better, and if they set it up that, okay, well, he just wants to get enough money to do this, and he does that, and it was easy, and it was kind of exciting and a little scary. And then something else comes along, and the most blunt way they do that was the VA part. So he shows up at a VA, which he had not done before. You know, he was a veteran at some point. I think they mentioned it. I forget if that was before or after, but you know, and he says, "Oh, you know, we need an extra $20,000 or whatever else it is," and then you know, he pays for that and what have you. So, like, there were opportunities throughout where you see him altruistically using the ill-gotten gains to help the people around him. That's a pretty good story. But that you're never quite sure, A, that he did it himself. Like the cosmetology school, too, thing. When his granddaughter graduates from that little rinky-dink beauty school.
Yeah, that's him paying for it, right?
Yeah, the ex-wife says, you know, she somehow managed to scrounge up the money to do this. And he's like, yeah, somehow.
Wink, wink.
And I'm like, there's your movie. That's how you kind of get him from point A to point B and how you keep him going on 12 runs. Like, I was waiting for a thing to happen on those runs just for the sake of something to happen, but nothing ever really does. And it's because they needed the story to keep going because they had so much else they wanted to do. But I kind of kept expecting something to go wrong, and nothing ever really goes wrong for this guy, with the exception of the change of leadership, and then he gets arrested at the end. But like, yeah. You know, I don't, you know, they would say, you know, first run, second run, third run. I'm thinking, okay, well, third one's going to be it. Oh, no, that's the eighth run. Like, well, what was he doing during all that time? You know, how much money are they actually giving him? You know, so.
Yeah, and there was not a proper escalation of danger to all those runs. So, like, he does get stopped by the cop who's looking, and he's like, oh, I just got pecans in here, and. You know, he confuses the dog so the dog doesn't smell the drugs. And then he does get stopped by another cop when they're eating food, and the cop hassles the handlers because they're Mexican. But that's like much, much later.
And it was so awkwardly done, too. Like, where were they supposed to be?
I think they were in...
Oh, Missouri. They were in Missouri. Missouri is... More of a Midwestern state than a Southern state, at least in the, you know, in the pop culture sense. And so it just looked kind of strange that, like, I don't know, it was just such a ham-fisted way to throw in some racism into the movie. That
well, there was also the Bradley Cooper pulls over another guy by mistake.
Oh, yeah, that was
and
weird.
That guy's going on and on, like, I don't want to get shot. Here's my wallet. You know, this is statistically the five most dangerous minutes of my life because he's petrified he's going to get shot. And then you find out not only does he not speak Mexican, he's not Mexican at all. He's like, because they said something like, I don't speak Mexican. And they look at his
Spanish.
Right, Spanish. Sorry.
Talking about racist.
And they look at his license. And when they look, and you don't see the picture, he goes, that's you? He goes, yeah. He goes, oh, I'm really sorry. Like, clearly he's not Hispanic or something. Like, he's like half black and he just doesn't pass.
His name is Steve Johnson.
Yeah, like you don't see it exactly, but you realize that they really fucked up. But they're, you know, I get what they were going for, but it felt very shoehorned because all the parts with Clint Eastwood's character are few and far between, and they're not done well. You know, like, do cops really just walk up to Hispanic guys and go, what are you doing in my town, son? I mean, in broad daylight at a restaurant. It's not like they're like in a bar somewhere.
Yeah, it was just like there was no way you'd be able to like what it.
Like, I'm sure they do, but not in well populated lit areas.
Yeah, it. So my complaint about that scene is that it reminds me about other complaints about that movie, three billboards outside of Ebbing, Missouri, or Ebbing, I guess it was Missouri. I don't know. But that movie, which was written by Martin McDonagh, who's an Irish playwright, writing about the American South, and people kept saying, like, this just comes off as cartoonish because we don't think this guy knows what the hell he's doing because he's not from here. You know, it'd be like one of us trying to write a play about the troubles in Northern Ireland. Like, we wouldn't really know how to approach that because we don't know anything about it. And it just seemed like that scene was sort of like, this is what cops do, right? When they meet people who are not white and they live in a white place, like, Maybe, I don't know. It just seemed awkward and sort of shoved in there just to give it, you know, the reason for it wasn't bad. Like, it gave...
It felt false.
And I could see why they wanted to do it. They wanted to give the Clint Eastwood character and the drug cartel guy a chance, like a reason to trust each other, or for them to trust him.
Mm-hmm.
To kind of build that bond that goes nowhere. You know, like that was in service of, you know, helping them become friends, and even though their friendship is worthless at the end, because it, you know, he doesn't save him. He just kind of lets the other crazy guy with the beard terrify him.
And even that guy at the end, when they can't find him for a week after the funeral.
Yeah.
And when they finally do, and he says, "I was at my ex-wife's funeral. I was at her bedside." And they're like, "You knew what would happen." And then they call the head cartel guy, and they're like, "Well, you know, do we really have to beat him up? I mean, it was his wife." I'm like, "Who's the villain in this being?" Like, somebody just wave a flag and says, "I'm the bad guy."
I think it's just cowboy hat guy.
Ugh, I mean, he wasn't that charming.
Yeah. Yeah. So
it was all right. Hey, it's well acted. That's about it.
That's true. Everybody in it was good. The granddaughter is actually the sister of Vera Farmiga. I don't know how to say your name.
I don't even know who that is.
She was in The Departed, and she plays Mrs. Bates in the Bates Motel show.
Oh.
She's pretty famous. Oh, she was in Up in the Air, too.
God, I haven't seen The Departed since we saw it in theaters.
Yeah, it doesn't hold up as well under... It's not...
I remember not being very impressed.
I liked the movie. I thought it was good.
I remember liking Mark Wahlberg.
Mark Wahlberg steals the show in that movie, yeah.
Yeah. I think that was the first time I was like, huh, who knew he could do that?
Well, right, because like, he had never had the opportunity, you know, he was just cast as leading man, you know, number 47. And he was just supposed to stand there and look handsome and try to be charming, even though he has almost no personality whatsoever. And I don't know if like what it is, because when you see him in interviews, he's very deadpan. Like, he's not an engaging, interesting person. But given the right set of circumstances, if he's told to be funny, he can do that. You know, movies like Ted and The Other Guys, and that ridiculous role in The Departed, which stood out in such contrast to everybody else who was so serious. And here comes this sort of insane, not goofball, because he wasn't unserious. He was just such a unique character amongst these, him and Alec Baldwin's character.
Yeah.
He's kind of like hyper intense, you know, but at the same time, you know, believable as people. Like, they didn't come across as like, well, no one acts like that. Well, I don't blame people who act that crazy, you know.
You know what? I was really surprised when this film, in the beginning, he was going through the hotel lobby of like where the horticulture awards were being given.
Yeah.
You know, and everyone knows him. He's charming the pants off everyone. And he passes one guy, and it was Richard Hurd. And I was shocked at how old he looked. I was like, oh my God.
Is he the guy from Star Trek?
Yes.
I could not place him till just now. He was Admiral Paris, right?
Yeah. He was George's boss on Seinfeld.
That's right.
At the Yankees.
God. I'm looking at this guy going, I know this guy. I've seen him before.
Yeah. And it wasn't. I haven't seen him in 20 years.
Yeah.
It's like, oh my God. Yeah, he was good, but it was one of those like jaw dropping. I couldn't believe how old he looked.
And Diane Wiest looks the same. She looked the same since, you know, I can't try to think.
Is that his wife?
Yeah.
Yeah.
She was like, I'm trying to think. So I always get Diane Wiest and Louise Fletcher confused.
Oh, yeah.
Like, either one of them could play like an older version of Hillary Clinton, if they wanted to, you know, that kind of cankly, you know, old white lady.
Yeah, the jowls.
Yeah. But they, like, Diane Weiss took over for I can't think of the actor's name. He played the DA on Law and Order like 20 years ago, and she looks pretty much the same as she did back then.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, all right.
Yeah.
It was good to see something that didn't involve explosions. At first, I was a little disappointed that there was no big gunfight or anything like that. And then I was like, you know what? This movie doesn't need it.
It doesn't need it. It would have been awkward to put it in. I still felt that the ending was kind of anticlimactic.
Oh, definitely.
And I'm trying to think what they could have done there differently. And I think possibly making it, like, either he gets away with it or he doesn't. And if he gets away with it, that's enough of a surprise that he outfoxed the DEA, and you know that's impressive. But like at the same time, he kind of can't, because then Bradley Cooper's character is totally pointless.
Well, when I thought they'd give him a chase,
right?
Because throughout the whole movie, they keep giving him a new cell phone. Keep this phone on you every moment. Answer it no matter what. Okay, and he says okay. And they try to teach him how to text on it and stuff like that. And that never comes up at all. They call him, but it's not, you know, important. I thought they'd be like, hey, gringo, they're on to you. Go this way, go that way. They sort of lead him on a chase, and then eventually he just get caught.
Well, not,
but that doesn't happen.
Not only do they not make use of it, but that object changes at the end of the movie. Because, like, the whole thing was that he... he keeps the phone, and when he goes to the second run, they go, "What, you still have this thing?" And they break it in front of him. He's like, "That's a perfectly good phone." He goes, "You have to throw them away. You can't keep them. They're burner phones for a reason." And they give him a new one. And then by the seventh or eighth run, you see him make the drop, get the money, and then very casually just open up the window and chuck the thing into the bin.
Yeah.
And then they give him one at the end when they tell him, okay, new rules, Pancho, and here's the dead guy in the trunk, and we're going to kill you if you don't do what we say. Here's this phone. You keep this one. And like they make a point to say, you don't throw this one away. You have to hang on to it.
But that doesn't make any difference either.
Right. That's my point. They made a point about the phone, even though the phone didn't serve a function. It was just... getting him to show that he's not good with technology.
Yeah, that's what I thought it was, like, set up as a gag. Like, oh, it's a perfectly good phone, and like, because he doesn't understand what it's for.
Right.
But if you're good at screenwriting, you would then have that be more important than what it is. You would say, like, you know, if you're going to, like, what's that old thing? You know, if you put a gun on stage in Act 1, you better have it fired by Act 3.
Yeah, Chekhov's blank. It was one of those funny things in that the podcast I heard about the Christmas movies that we talked about a while ago, was that in all those really bad movies, there's always a thing that, you know, they mention kind of obviously in the beginning, and they don't mention it again until the very end. Like in the stupid shoe movie, it was it was Chekhov's HR file from the basement. That it turns out that the file from the basement was of the woman who was in the picture she took, and that was like they made this weird connection. And so the person on the podcast called it Chekhov's blank, whatever the hell it was, handgun, you know, fire hose, doesn't matter what it is. But yeah, it's a thing from
right.
Chekhov.
So it should have had some sort of importance besides, like, if they were constantly going to keep bringing it up, it should have had more to do in terms of usefulness to the story.
Yeah, like the whole thing about texting and, like, how he can't do it and he has to figure out me in, like, a desperate moment, he figures out how to do it. And here's a question I had. So the whole time... he's making these runs for the most part. He's leaving the truck at a motel to do the drop. Then one time when he's asking the kid, how do I text numbers and not just letters? And he gives him an address. That was the address of where the guy who gets the car from the motel goes and takes it and then brings the car back, right? And he was never supposed to go there?
Right. I think so.
That's unclear. And that, I think, is the kid that they kill.
Yeah.
Because he inadvertently, you know, or mistakenly gave Earl the address
to like the safe house.
To the actual drop location, not just the motel.
Mm-hmm.
So sucks to be that kid. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, and that doesn't play much of an important thing either.
No.
Like,
because then he keeps making the drops there. Like, well, you know, we're here now, so you might as well.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay. So yeah, just not a well structured film at all. And like, there are ways to do it. Like, you can look at it and go, well, if you had just done this, if you had just done that, kind of tweak it, and you can make a movie out of it. But you'd have to pare a lot of it down and focus on a few things rather than just.
Okay.
No, that would be fine. You know, there was kind of too much going on here. Like, and what happens at the end is they get him, and he's sitting there in the back of the cop car, and giving, you know, sage life lessons to the Bradley Cooper character, whose name he was so kind of inconsequential as a character that you didn't even need to know. He could have been literally a nobody.
Yeah,
you know. But he's like, they're trying to ham fist in some last minute, you know, don't do what I did. Don't miss your anniversaries. Just go home kind of thing. He's like, I'm trying to think. You're the reason he's here. You've been running drugs for the cartel. If you didn't do that, you know, and if you weren't so good at it, this guy would be home with his wife instead of running around looking for your ass.
Yeah, but also Bradley Cooper has a job that's time-consuming and demanding of him.
And important.
Yes, but being a horticulturist is not... You're supposed to get the idea, that, like the sense that Clint Eastwood was out on the road hobnobbing with people.
Yeah.
But did he have to do that? Like, his ex-wife is like, you didn't have to be doing those things. You could have grown flowers and still been at home, or like not on the road as often.
Right. That
because
was my...
the only time you see him doing that is when he's at a convention winning an award. He's not hawking anything. I mean, he does sell his flowers, but that's not the main reason that he's there. Bradley Cooper has to be in these positions.
Right. Which was my point when like they were trying to hold up these two characters as having similar things, even though they're not. Because yeah, you're right. Like, you know, he was doing the wrong thing by carousing with people instead of going home to his family, and Cooper's out there being a, you know, doing a dangerous and important job for the, you know, to protect people from the drug cartels. And so they're trying to, you know, we're just the same, you and I, and they're not.
Yeah, we're not so different.
God.
Yes. Yes, I am.
So, would you recommend The Mule?
No, just go rent Unforgiven, I guess.
Yeah.
You know.
I'm trying to think what else I saw. Like, that's good. That. I saw a bit of Trouble with the Curve, but not much. That wasn't that good. This is. But there's not a whole lot else playing right now, so we're kind of in the doldrums before the Oscars.
I know. Well, I teach high school kids, all boys, and they are peeing their pants in anticipation of the next Avengers film. So,
is that in May?
That's in I think it's in May.
Huh.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Oh yeah, they're having conniption fits. Which, you know what, if I was 15, I absolutely would be too. So
yeah. I started rewatching Infinity War before, as I was just eating my dinner. That movie is not rewatchable.
Your fault. That's false.
No, I don't like it. It's not that good.
Oh, it's yeah, well, that's your opinion. Did you ever see that sketch with, you know, Norm Macdonald? He was on Celebrity Jeopardy.
Yes.
And he's talking to Will Ferrell, and he's supposed to be Burt Reynolds.
Oh, yeah.
And he changes the name on the teleprompter thingy. It's a Turd Ferguson. And he goes, so he buzzes in, and Will Ferrell's like, yes, Burt Reynolds. He goes, that's not my name. Goes, okay, Turd Ferguson. Yeah, what do you want? He goes, you rang in. No, I didn't. Yes, you did. Yeah, well, it's your opinion. Like, he won't answer the question. So I just throw that in people. Yeah, well, that's your opinion. Like, choppy Burt Reynolds style.
Rest in peace. All right. Well, if you out there want to tell us what you thought of The Mule, I'm sorry we actually never got to have Mr. Eastwood on. He's old, though. He probably just didn't know how to find the house. It's okay.
What's a podcast?
Exactly. Can't imagine having this. So I just talk into this thing. We are not on the air right now. No, sir, we are not. To explain everything.
Reaching dozens of people.
Yeah. But yeah, so if you want to tell us what you thought of this movie, you can tweet us or send us a picture on Instagram. We are at Three Drinks in Pod. We are available on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, Overcast, and Radio Public. Click subscribe, tell your friends, leave a review. Like us on Facebook also. Email us threedrinksinpodcast@gmail.com. Anything else to add about this one?
No, I think we're good.
Okay. As always, please drink responsibly, and we'll talk to you all next time.
Yep, take care.
Bye.